short books, and there's not a whole lot of them. There's three historical and three prophetic. When we were surveying the whole Bible earlier in the year, I think I pointed out that of the historical books of the Old Testament, there are five major historical books that are also called the Pentateuch, and 12 lesser historical books. And of the lesser historical books, which begin at Joshua and Judges and through the books of Kings and Chronicles and Samuel and so forth, of those lesser books of history, nine of them are pre-exilic and three are post-exilic. That is, before the Babylonian exile and after the Babylonian exile. And when we come to the prophets, it's really very much the same. There are 17 books of prophecy. There are the five, which are the major ones, just like there are five major books of history, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. So the major prophets would be considered to be Isaiah and Jeremiah and Lamentations and Ezekiel and Daniel. Of course, Lamentations isn't really a separate prophet, but just a short other book by Jeremiah. But we include it as a separate book among the major prophets, since it is believed to be by Jeremiah. Then there are 12 of the minor prophets. And just like the 12 lesser books of Old Testament history, which divide into 9 and 3, that is 9 pre-exilic and 3 post-exilic, so it is with the minor prophets. There are 12. There are 9 pre-exilic and 3 post-exilic. So we've covered everything so far in the Old Testament that comes up to and into and through the Babylonian exile. Daniel and Ezekiel, most recently we studied, and they were in the exile. And when we come to Ezra and Esther and Nehemiah, we have the closing historical books of the Old Testament. They don't bring us all the way up to the New Testament period, however. In fact, they close about 400 years before the New Testament begins. There's a gap in the Old Testament history of 400 years from the time that the recorded Old Testament history closes till the time that the New Testament opens. That is called the intertestamental period because it's between the two testaments. We'll have something to say about that. In fact, you've studied something about that as we went through Daniel. Daniel chapter 11 and the kings of the south and of the north and the intrigues and the battles and so forth between those kings and Daniel chapter 11 involved us in some discussion of that intertestamental period. The Seleucids and the Ptolemies and the Antiochus Epiphanes. You will be familiar with that from our studies in Daniel. Anyway, all that we have to study now of the Old Testament history is Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And we have three prophets that belong to the post-exilic period. And they are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And all of these are shorter books. Although Zechariah has 14 chapters, they're short chapters. And they're very easy to get through several in a sitting. So we have pretty small books to cover, and we hope to cover them all this week. Now, we're going to take them in the order in which they occurred, not the order in which they appear in our Bibles. As we have it in our Bibles, it's Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. But that's not really the correct chronological order. Ezra, as a matter of fact, divides into two portions. Ezra chapters 1 through 6, and Ezra chapters 7 through 10. And between those two sections is a gap of about 60 years, which passes silently. Ezra makes no reference to that 60-year period. But between the close of Ezra chapter 6 and the opening of Ezra chapter 7, we have a 60-year gap. And during that gap, the story of Esther takes place, followed by the closing chapters of Ezra, followed by the story of Nehemiah. So the way we'll take it chronologically is, right now, we'll cover Ezra chapters 1 through 6. The next historical information we'll get to will be Esther. Then we'll go through Ezra chapters 7 through 10, and then the book of Nehemiah. That's the order in which we'll take it, because that's chronological. Now, after we cover Ezra chapters 1 through 6, we will take a break from the historical treatment to insert the prophets who belong to that period. Those are Zechariah and Haggai. Zechariah and Haggai were contemporaries with this period of the first six chapters of Ezra. And so we'll cover those prophets and their prophecies and their impact after we cover these six chapters. And then we'll get into the other chapters after Esther and so forth. So we'll just take all this material in the order that is logical to take, rather than the order that it's arranged in. Now, in Ezra and Nehemiah, these two historical books, we have the story of the return of the exiles in three waves, or three increments, or whatever. There were three periods of return, just as there were three periods of exile. I mean, there were three waves of exile. When Nebuchadnezzar came on three different occasions and took Jews into captivity, there were three different occasions, separated by many years in some cases, where exiles returned. You know that Babylon fell to the Medo-Persians, to the Persians particularly, Medes and Persians. And then Cyrus, the conqueror, gave a decree allowing the Jews to go back to their land. His decree is recorded in the closing verses of 2 Chronicles. In fact, that's how 2 Chronicles closes. It kind of skips over the 70 years and then tells of the decree of Cyrus when he conquered Babylon and allowed the children of Israel to go back to Jerusalem. And the book of Ezra opens with the same words, practically. Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 3 are almost identical, word for word, with the closing verses, the last two verses of 2 Chronicles, which has led many to believe that the same author wrote the books of Chronicles and the books of Ezra. Actually, Ezra and Nehemiah, in the oldest manuscripts, are one document, just as the two books of Kings and the two books of Chronicles and the two books of Samuel in the original Hebrew Bible are all just one book each. One book of Kings, one book of Samuel, one book of Chronicles. So Ezra and Nehemiah was one book in the original. The first to come along and divide them into two was one of the church fathers, one of the later church fathers, Origen, who lived from about 185 A.D. to 253 A.D. So into the second and third centuries of the church is the period that we're talking about when these books first came to be divided into two. Since the books were one document originally, it is supposed that one author wrote them. Traditionally, the Jews believe that Ezra wrote these books of Ezra and Nehemiah. We know that Ezra is a main character in the second section of the book of Ezra. And he also is still around in the book of Nehemiah. So he was contemporary with the events and could have written both books. And it is the tradition of the Jews that he did. And therefore, it is also the tradition of the Jews that he wrote the books of Chronicles, which, as I said, close with the very same words that the book of Ezra opens with. The book of Ezra follows immediately upon the end of 2 Chronicles, and so it is traditional among the Jews to assign the authorship of the books of Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah to this man, Ezra. Ezra was one of the most significant characters in Old Testament history, although very little in terms of number of chapters are given to the description of his life. Some people feel that he is the second most important person in Jewish history, second only to Moses. Now, there would be some who probably would dispute that, but he played the role of reinstituting the law and reestablishing the Jewish religion after the Jews had returned from Babylon. And what Moses did at Sinai, Ezra did at Jerusalem with the returned exiles, and therefore he's a very significant character, although, like I said, you wouldn't know it from the number of chapters given to his story, as opposed to all the chapters about Moses in the Old Testament. But he is more than a little bit significant. Now, the first section, the first six chapters of Ezra, don't have the man Ezra at all in them. They are of the earlier period. As I said, there's a 60-year gap between the earlier and the latter period in the book of Ezra. And so Ezra was not alive during the earlier period, though he very well may have written it as history. The main leader in Ezra chapters 1 through 6 is a man named Zerubbabel. Now, Zerubbabel was a descendant of the kings of Judah. He was a grandson, I believe, Jehoiakim. And he's the last of David's descendants to have any political authority in Israel. He was not, however, a king. He was a governor. Zerubbabel was made governor by Cyrus, apparently, and allowed to take the first group of exiles back to Jerusalem. I'd like to call your attention to this chart I have over here on this board, because it'll give you some idea of the history which we are probably not very familiar with otherwise. Most of us are not expert in Persian history, and so I'd like to familiarize you with a little bit here. You'll notice there's three columns on this chart. The first column gives the name of a Persian king and the period during which he reigned. The next column gives the biblical history that's associated with that period of each one's reign. And then in the third column, you have whatever prophets were prophesying at the same time. Now, the first of the kings to consider is the one who conquered Babylon, Cyrus. And you can see his reign was from 559 to 530 B.C. He didn't conquer Babylon until 539, but he rose to power among his people in 559. It is he who gave the decree to allow Zerubbabel and 50,000 with him to return to Jerusalem and rebuild it. And Daniel the prophet was still around during that time as well. Although Daniel was apparently too old to return with the other exiles, Daniel would have been probably well into his 80s or 90s at this time, since he was a young man at the time when the exile began, and now 70 years have passed. He probably was nearly 90 years old and probably just considered himself too old to make the return. Cyrus gave a decree that allowed any Jew who wanted to leave the region of the exile, whether it be Babylon or Persia or wherever they were scattered to, and to go back and help to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. This was predicted, you know, by Isaiah, chapters 44 and 45, the closing verses of 44 and the opening verses of 45 of Isaiah, that Cyrus would do just that. The next king on there is Cambyses, who reigned from 530 to 522, the successor of Cyrus. There is no biblical history recorded associated with his reign, so we'll pass over it here. It was only a reign of about 8 years. And then the third is Darius the First, who reigned from 522 to 486 B.C. It was he during whose reign the temple was completely rebuilt. Now, Zerubbabel, back in the period of Cyrus, had begun the building of the temple, but because he met so much opposition, he discontinued his work. And for 16 years, the Jews didn't do any further work on the temple because of the opposition they received. But after 16 years, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, during the reign of Darius, arose and prophesied that the people should begin to rebuild. And so they did, and within a few years' time, they completely rebuilt the temple. So the work was begun during the reign of Cyrus under Zerubbabel, but it was not completed until Haggai and Zechariah, the contemporary prophets of that period, in the reign of Darius the First, prophesied and encouraged, and Zerubbabel also was leading at that time. He and Joshua the high priest led the people in rebuilding the temple. The fourth king is Xerxes the First. He reigned from 486 to 465 B.C., and there's nothing about him in the book of Ezra or Nehemiah except a brief mention of him in one verse, but he's the king in the book of Esther. He's the one who married Esther. Esther was his queen. So he married a Jewish girl, and she saved her people from extinction at that time, as the book of Esther tells us about. And the last king on the list is Artaxerxes the First. Now, there were three Artaxerxes, but it's the first of them that was reigning at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. That is the second portion of the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah, Ezra 7 through 10, and the book of Nehemiah. These are the stories of those men. Ezra and Nehemiah were contemporaries of one another, and Artaxerxes the First, who reigned from 464 to 423 B.C., was the king in Persia. And the prophet at that time was Malachi. Actually, we don't know exactly the date of Malachi. It is assumed by many that Malachi prophesied during the time when Nehemiah was governor of Judea. Anyway, that's where we put the prophet Malachi. And that gives you some idea of the chronology here. So here in the reigns of Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius the First, this is what the first six chapters of Ezra cover. And then when we skip over the reign of Xerxes, who's called Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. And we go down to Artaxerxes for the last four chapters of Ezra in the book of Nehemiah. So you can see how things chronologically line up. Okay, now we'll get into the story itself. A lot of the story that we have before us in the first six chapters is made up of lists of names, which means that some of this material we can skip over with only a summary statement, because there's scores of names of people whose names are, I mean, really insignificant. We don't know anything about them, but that their names appear in a list. And we're not going to try to comment on the significance of all those names because we don't know anything about most of the people who are in those lists. Now, I should point out, perhaps, that like the book of Daniel, Ezra has certain portions written in the Aramaic language. Most of the Old Testament, almost all of it, is written in the Hebrew language. But Daniel and Ezra are the two books that have a couple of exceptions. Daniel has a few chapters written in Aramaic, although it also has Hebrew chapters. It has Aramaic chapters. In Ezra also, we have a couple of sections that were originally written in Aramaic, and the rest was in Hebrew. The portions that are written in Aramaic, I'll tell you where they are so you can identify them. The Aramaic portions are chapter 4, verse 8, through chapter 6, verse 18. That's Ezra 4, 8, through 6, 18. And also Ezra chapter 7, verses 12 through 26. These, as I said, are written, unlike the rest of the book, these are written in Aramaic, chapter 7, verses 12 through 26. And those Aramaic portions mainly consist of official documents and letters written to the Persian king and the history surrounding it. Aramaic was the language of business at the time of the Persian reign. And therefore, we get the impression that these Aramaic portions are copied directly out of the original court documents or whatever, because they would have been written in Aramaic. It would seem like Ezra, in writing this book, if he is the author, chose not to translate them into Hebrew, but simply to write them word for word as they appeared in the official documents. And that explains why we have them in Aramaic. Okay, now, let's begin at the beginning here. The year is 538 B.C. It says, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? May his God be with him. Now let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whoever remains in any place where he sojourns, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Now, as I said, these verses are almost identical to the closing verses of 2 Chronicles. And this is the first wave of captives were allowed to be released and go back to Jerusalem. It says in verse 1 that this was that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Well, Jeremiah didn't have anything anywhere near as much to say about this as Isaiah did. And Isaiah isn't mentioned, but Jeremiah did predict that the captivity would be 70 years in duration. That's in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 11 and 12. We're told that the captivity in Babylon would last 70 years. The year of this decree was 538 B.C. It was 67 years after the first stage of Judah's captivity. Remember, the first stage of the captivity took place in 605 B.C. So this was 67 years later, just 3 years short of 70. And by the time that the temple was actually rebuilt, it was 70 years after the original siege of Jerusalem. So here we have almost 70 years expired. And so he says this is so that Jeremiah's word might be fulfilled. Well, the only thing that Jeremiah really predicted clearly was the 70-year duration. We know that Isaiah predicted that Cyrus himself would release the people and would be instrumental in the rebuilding of the city and of the foundation of the temple. And we see that here in verse 2. Cyrus says in his decree, the Lord God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. If you check out Isaiah chapter 44, verses 28 through chapter 45, verse 1, you'll see that it says that Cyrus would be instrumental in building the house of Judah, which doesn't mean he did it, but he released the Jews to do it and gave them finances. He also gave permission, as we can see, for any Jewish person who wanted to return to Jerusalem. And those who preferred not to go, verse 4 says, should help financially with the task. Now, one might wonder why not all the Jews would want to go back. As it turns out, about 50,000 went back at this time, and some others afterwards. But eventually, there were still, the majority of the Jews had never returned, it would seem, back to Jerusalem. It seems that the majority stayed in Babylon. These would be the children and grandchildren of the original exiles, people who had been born and raised in Babylon, and no doubt now had the prospect of being prosperous there. Even during the captivity, they weren't treated too terribly badly, it would appear. And then now that the captivity was over, some of them had positions of power, as we see in the book of Esther. Mordecai and Esther were both Jewish exiles who had positions of power. Daniel, of course, had positions of power, as did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Jeremiah had written to those exiles before this time and told them to go ahead and build houses and plant vineyards and settle in and, you know, dig in for the long haul. And so some of the people had just come to think of Babylon as home. And not all of them wanted to go back. This is not necessarily good, but it's the way it was. And only, I think, what the prophets would have called the remnant, whose hearts were touched by God, went back. And so God moved on certain people to go back. And it says that in verse 5. Then the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin, with the priests and the Levites, with all those whose spirits God had moved, arose to go up and to build the house of the Lord, which is at Jerusalem. So God touched the hearts or the spirits of certain people to go. It's interesting. These would have to be the remnant of which we read so much in the pre-exilic prophets, the remnant that would return. And they were really a relatively small remnant, as it turns out. Verse 6 says, and all those who were around them encouraged them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with precious things besides all that was willingly offered. King Cyrus also brought out the articles of the house of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from Jerusalem and put in the temple of his gods. Now, the articles of the temple, we read about them being taken before. We remember also, on the evening of Babylon's fall to Cyrus, that Nebuchadnezzar had taken some of those vessels out of storage that had been taken from the Jerusalem temple and was defiling them by drinking toasts to the heathen gods. And that was when the writing appeared on the wall that spelled the doom. That wasn't Nebuchadnezzar, it was Belshazzar, excuse me. Belshazzar did that. And Cyrus came and conquered the city and killed Belshazzar that very night. And now he took all these vessels that had been taken and delivered them over, as it says in verse 8, to somebody named Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. It says, verse 8, and Cyrus, the king of Persia, brought them out by the hand of Mithridat, the treasurer, that'd be the Persian treasurer, and counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Now, this man, Sheshbazzar, is mentioned elsewhere also in the book of Ezra, and it's kind of perplexing, because he is said to be the prince of Judah, and elsewhere he's said to be the governor of Judah, and yet that's the title that Zerubbabel holds in this story. And there are three theories. One is that Sheshbazzar is another name for Zerubbabel. And we'll consider the evidence for that in a moment. Another theory is that Sheshbazzar was an older contemporary of Zerubbabel, and that when he died, or maybe when he was just old and in somewhat retirement, Zerubbabel became more prominent in the same office. And some have identified Sheshbazzar with a man named Shenazar, who's mentioned in 1 Chronicles 3.18. 1 Chronicles 3.18, who is the fourth son of Jehoiakim and the uncle of Zerubbabel.
What's his name again?
Shenazar. S-H-E-N-A-Z-Z-A-R. The name is similar to Sheshbazzar, and some feel it may be the same man. My opinion, there are three choices, and these are lined out, I noticed, in the notes at the foot of the page on the NIV study Bible, the options here. There are four good reasons to identify Sheshbaz with Zerubbabel. That is to say, they were the same person. One, both of them are said to be governors. In chapter 5, verse 14, it says, also the gold and the silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple and was that was in Jerusalem and carried away to Babylon, those the king Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon. And it says, were given to one named Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. And yet, Zerubbabel is also called governor. Over in Haggai, chapter 1 and verse 1, and chapter 2 and verse 2 of Haggai also. Zerubbabel is referred to as the governor. So both Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel are called governor. That's one reason to identify them as the same person. Another is that both are given credit for having laid the foundation of the temple. If you'll notice chapter 3, verses 2 through 8, it says, then Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, arose and built the altar of God. And then it says down in, down in verse 8, now in the second month of the second year of their coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brethren, and the priests and the Levites, and all those who had come out of the captivity to Jerusalem began to work, appointed the Levites from 20 years old and above to oversee the work of the house of God, and so forth. So the first thing they did, of course, was, verse 10, when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in apparel and trumpets and so forth, and they celebrated. Now, it mentions they laid the foundation of the temple, and the man who was the governor at the time was said to be Zerubbabel, in Ezra chapter 3, verses 2 and 8. And yet, Sheshbazzar is also given credit for that accomplishment. In chapter 5 and verse 16, 5:16 says, then the same Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. That's part of a letter that's recounting it. So both Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar are given credit for having laid the foundation of the temple. Also in favor of the view that the two names belong to the same individual is the fact that we know from the book of Daniel that many of the Jewish captives were given Babylonian names by the Babylonian kings. And Sheshbazzar is a Babylonian name, whereas Zerubbabel is a Hebrew name. And it would seem that very likely that the man had both names. Zerubbabel would be his name from birth, given by his Jewish parents. Sheshbazzar could be the Babylonian name given to him, you know, as a captive, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not the original names of those men, but were Babylonian names that were given to them. And Daniel was given a name also, Belteshazzar. So there is some support there for the idea that the two names could belong to the same person. A fourth reason for identifying them is that Josephus, in his account, says they were the same person. Now, Josephus is not inspired, of course, and so we don't know, but Josephus believed that Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel were the same person. Although there are other apocryphal books that don't belong in our Old Testament that were written by the Jews in the intertestamental period that make a distinction between the two men and say they were different men. So the thing can't be settled completely, but there is enough evidence to suggest that Sheshbazzar is just another name for Zerubbabel, and that's the assumption I'm going to proceed upon. Now, Ezra 1, verse 9. This is the number of them, that is, of the vessels of the temple. 30 gold platters, 1,000 silver platters, 29 knives, 30 gold basins, 410 silver basins of a similar kind, and 1,000 other articles. Now, this total of articles given in verses 9 and 10 is only 2,499. If you total all those up, it comes to 2,499. And yet a much larger total is given in verse 11. It says, all the articles of gold and silver were 5,400. Now, that's more than twice as many as are mentioned in verses 9 and 10. Probably what we are to understand is that the ones numbered in 9 and 10 are the major, you know, the major pieces. And there must have been a lot of other little things. And so the larger number given in verse 11 is filling in the total number of items, although the enumerated items in verses 9 and 10 would be just the major pieces, the bigger pieces, or whatever, which there were only 2,499. But altogether, all the articles of gold and silver were 5,400. All these Sheshbazzar took with the captives who were brought from Babylon to Jerusalem. This trip from Babylon to Jerusalem would not be much more than about 500 miles as the crow flies. But usually, travelers didn't go straight in a straight line between those two places because it's just barren desert. They would usually move up to the north and then come back down from the north. And so the way they traveled was probably closer to 1,000 miles, almost twice as far as the distance as the crow flies. So it was quite a long trip. According to the later story about Ezra's return, it took Ezra 4 months to make this trip. We don't know how long it took Sheshbazzar or Zerubbabel and the captives to make the trip, but it was probably about the same. Probably it was about a 4 month trip, almost 1,000 miles journey. Chapter 2. Now these are the people of the province who came back from the captivity and those who had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away to Babylon, and who returned to Jerusalem and Judah, everyone to his own city. Those who came with Zerubbabel were Joshua, who is the high priest, Nehemiah — that's not the same Nehemiah who's in the book of Nehemiah. This is too early for that. This is a generation or two before that. Sariah, Realiah, Mordecai. Now Mordecai is another name we find elsewhere. We find that name in the book of Esther. Esther had a cousin or an uncle by that name. But this is not the same man. This is, again, too early for that. And then it goes through many other names. In verses 3 through 20, it just gives names of various families or clans and gives the numbers of each clan or each family that came. Then in verses 20 through 35, we have people from various towns. It doesn't give family names, but names of towns, most of them in the area of Benjamin. The people of Gibar, 95, verse 20. People of Bethlehem, very possibly Jesus' ancestors, 123, and so forth. It goes on down in verses 20 through 35 through the various towns that these people had come from and were now returning to. Then it gives, in verses 36 through 39, the number of the priests who returned. There were a total of 4,289 priests. That's actually a very huge number. It's about 10% of the people who return. Almost one-tenth of the people who return were priests. Now, that's not just of the tribe of Levi. I mean, if 10% were Levites, you might say, well, that should be about right. I mean, the Levites were one tribe in 12, and therefore to have about 10% be Levites wouldn't be too surprising. But we're talking not about Levites, but priests. And the priests, of course, were one narrow family of the Levites. And there was a huge number of priests that came back, and surprisingly, not very many Levites. In verse 40, it says the Levites, the sons of Joshua and Kadmiel, of the sons of Hodaviah, 74. Only 74 Levites. Now, Levites outnumbered priests in the Jewish population by a goodly amount, I'm sure. But among those that returned, there was a huge number of priests and a very small number of Levites, probably because the priests were the privileged ones who got to, you know, work in the temple and had a high honored position there, whereas the Levites were kind of the workers of menial chores around the temple. They didn't have quite the exalted status of priests, and probably some of them found that the work they had in Babylon was less menial and more, ego satisfying or whatever than the things they did. They'd have to be doing carrying water and, you know, burning carcasses and so forth that they'd have to be doing if they went back. I don't know if that's the reason that so few Levites made it back or not, but it's rather interesting that there were so few Levites and so many priests. Verse 41, the singers, the sons of Asaph, 128. Asaph was a priest and singer during the time of David, and his offspring were famous singers in Israel. They sang at the temple. The sons of the gatekeepers, verse 42, and the sons of Shalom, the sons of Ader, the sons of Talmud, the sons of Akkab, the sons of Hadith, the sons of Shobai, 139 in all. Now, there were 139 gatekeepers, 128 singers. And then we have the temple servants in verse 43 through 58. Their total number was 392. And it gives names of their families. In verse 55, part of that discussion, it says the sons of Solomon's servants, and gives some of their names. Solomon's servants' sons probably refers to the Canaanite people that Solomon put under servitude, and these were the Canaanite descendants, or the descendants of those Canaanite people. In 1 Kings 9, verses 20 and 21, it talks about Solomon putting certain Canaanites under forced labor. And these probably, the sons of Solomon's servants, probably refers to the descendants of those. Okay, verse 59. And these were the ones who came from Tel Melah, Tel Harsha, Cherub, Adan, and Immer. These places are towns in Babylonia where the exiles had been living during the captivity, and these people came from there. It says, but they could not identify their father's house or their genealogy, whether they were of Israel. And it gives some of the names. Now, they had lost their genealogical records, and therefore they couldn't prove their descent. And it says in verse 62, these sought their listing among those that were registered by genealogy, but they were not found. Therefore, they were excluded from the priesthood as defiled. Now, apparently these were people who have a priestly lineage, or at least believed they did, but couldn't prove it from genealogies. Their personal genealogies have been destroyed or something, and therefore they were not allowed to be in the priesthood until it could be proven that they were really of the right family. And it says in verse 63, the governor said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things until a priest should consult with the Urim and the Thummim. Presumably they were able to do that, and some of these men were probably later entered into the priesthood when the Urim and the Thummim was able to determine the mind of God about it and what their true genealogy was. It gives the total then of all these groups. It's divided, it's given different categories, you know, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, and so forth. The total is given here in 64 as 42,360. Now, once again, this is a larger number than the combined total of all the numbers that were given before, but probably that's because there were people who didn't fit in any of these categories that also joined them. For example, women and children, perhaps, who weren't named among them. I don't know. We don't know exactly why the number is different, but there is actually the number 42,360 is lower than the total of what was mentioned in the preceding things. Verse 65, besides their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 200 men and women. So when you add the over 7,000 servants to the number 42,360, it comes out to about 50,000 total. Then it tells how many horses and camels and donkeys they had. Verse 68, some of the heads of the fathers' houses, when they came to the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem, offered freely for the house of God, to erect it in its place, according to their ability, they gave to the treasury for the work 61,000 gold drachmas, 5,000 minyas of silver, and 100 priestly garments. So the priests and the Levites, some of the people and singers and gatekeepers and the Nethinim dwelt in their cities, and all Israel in their cities. Now, they needed to restore worship in the holy city. There was no temple, and worship consisted of sacrifices. It's interesting that they reestablished the sacrificial system before they rebuilt the temple. But they did set up an altar in the place where the temple had been. And so they could start offering sacrifices right away. It says in chapter 3, when the seventh month had come. Now this is the most sacred month of the Jewish calendar. That's the month where they have the Feast of Tabernacles. And they also had, of course, the Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur in the seventh month. So this is their most sacred month. It says, and when the seventh month had come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. Then Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Now, they hadn't had any altars. They hadn't had a temple. They hadn't had any sacrifices for 70 years. So they had a lot of sins to atone for all that period of time. Zerubbabel is the governor. The man Jeshua, in verse 2, also is another form of the name Joshua, is the high priest. These are the two leaders that are mentioned in the books of Zechariah and Haggai. Those prophets prophesied to these men to encourage them in their work, and they are to be considered the main leaders of the first wave of returnees. Okay? As I said, Zerubbabel was himself descended from the Davidic line. He was a grandson of Jehoiakim, and he was the last of David's offspring to have any political title in Jerusalem. He was, however, an ancestor of Jesus. Jesus was descended from Zerubbabel, according to Matthew chapter 1, verses 12 and 13. Verse 3, though fear had come upon them because of the people of those countries, they set the altar on its bases, and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, both the morning and the evening burnt offerings. They also kept the Feast of the Tabernacles, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings in the number required by ordinances for each day. And afterward they offered the regular burnt offering, and those for new moons, and for all the appointed feasts of the Lord that were consecrated, and those of everyone who willingly offered a freewill offering to the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, but the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not yet been laid. They also gave money to the masons and the carpenters, and the food, drink, and oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre to bring cedar logs. You might remember that when Solomon had first built the temple, there was cedar wood from Tyre, from Hiram, the king of Tyre, that was used. And now they're buying some more cedar to rebuild the temple from the same people. Same country, that is. Cedar logs from Lebanon to the sea at Joppa, according to the permission which they had from Cyrus, the king of Persia. Okay, so verse 3 says, fear had come upon them because of the people of those countries. When the Assyrians had deported the 10 tribes to the north in 722 BC, they had repopulated that region, which was later Galilee and Samaria in Jesus' day, that northern region of Palestine. The Assyrians had repopulated it with foreigners, many of which had intermarried with Jews, and now there's kind of a half-breed Jewish-Gentile race of people there. These Samaritans, as they came to be called, were opposers of the rebuilding of Jerusalem and of the temple. They opposed Zerubbabel, apparently. They opposed Nehemiah also, as we shall see. In fact, in chapter 4, we're going to see a sort of a summary of how many times they opposed this project. But this rebuilding of the temple was not done without opposition. And it took some rather heroic leaders to do it. Even though they had permission from the king of Persia, the local authorities didn't like them. And there were actually plots on the life of Nehemiah. He was very much in danger many times. And he had to arm the workers at the wall eventually because of this kind of opposition. Well, it says here that even though there was fear that had come upon them in chapter 3, verse 3... They went ahead and did it. And God protected them from harm on this occasion. Verse 8, now in the second month of the year, which is April and May of the year 536 B.C., which is the same month that Solomon had begun building the temple. He had begun in the second month also, according to 1 Kings 6:1. They originally built the first temple. It says that they appointed the Levites to do the work. And at the end of verse 8, it says the Levites from 20 years old and above to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. Now, 20 years old is a little young for a Levite to begin his ministry according to earlier standards. In Numbers chapter 4, in verse 3, the lower age limit for a Levite to enter the ministry was age 30. Later on in Numbers, chapter 8, verse 24, it seems to have been reduced to the age 25. But now it's reduced to age 20, probably due to the fact that there were so few Levites. They had to get as many of them as possible working And so it was lowered to age 20, and the Levites began to oversee it, who were 20 years old and above. Verse 9. Then Joshua with his sons and brothers, Kadmiel with his sons and the sons of Judah, arose as one to oversee those working on the house of God, the sons of Henadad with their sons and the brethren of the Levites. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, and praise the Lord according to the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. And they sang responsibly, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever toward Israel. Now it says they sang responsibly. It probably means they had two choirs that would sing to each other, responding to each other. Or it could mean that they had a choir leader who sing out something and the whole choir would respond back. This is called antiphonal singing. When there's two groups, either a leader and the choir, or two choirs singing back and forth to each other. That's what they did to worship the Lord on the occasion of the laying the foundation of the temple. It says that all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Verse 12. But many of the priests and the Levites, the heads of the fathers' houses, who were old men, who had seen the first temple, and they would have had to be very old, probably in their 80s or 90s, and they had been children when they saw the old one. They wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple were laid before their eyes, yet many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard afar off. Now, this weeping of the older men could be weeping for joy, but more likely they were weeping because they realized that they were not going to have a new temple that was anything like the old one. They remembered the old one, and Solomon had a huge budget. David had taken a huge collection from the people during the most prosperous period of Jews' history. He took this enormous collection so that Solomon had all these resources to build the temple. He built it. It was one of the seven wonders of the world. It took him 7 years to build it, and it's overlaid with gold and everything, and it's just an immense and wonderful structure. Now, it was a great thing that the Jews were going to have a temple again, but these men could see immediately that the new foundation was much smaller. They didn't have the budget to make a temple like the one that had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And they may well have been weeping because they missed the old one. In the book of Haggai, there is who was, of course, contemporary at this time, there is a reference made to those who had seen the earlier temple and how maybe this new temple didn't seem to them to be quite so impressive. In Haggai chapter 2 and verse 3, the prophet says, "Who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? And how do you see it now? In comparison with it, is this not in your eyes as nothing?" In other words, this new temple is like nothing in your eyes, those of you who saw the old temple. However, he goes on to predict that this new temple is going to be even more glorious than the first. Not in terms of its construction, but in other terms, because the glory of the Lord will be revealed in it. Now going on to chapter 4. Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do." Now these Samaritans did sort of seek the Lord, but not really purely. And the Jews wouldn't have anything to do with them. The Samaritan people up there had originally brought their false gods in when the Assyrians brought them in to repopulate the area that had been the northern kingdom of Israel. They brought their false gods with them, the worship of their false gods. And you might remember that lions were sent by the Lord and tore up some of those people. And so they realized that the God of the region, Jehovah, was angry. And they brought Levites or priests in to teach the people how to worship Jehovah. Well, of course, they didn't really worship Jehovah in the prescribed way. First of all, they didn't have a temple. They didn't have the sacrificial system. They didn't have all that stuff. But there must have been some sense in which they adjusted their behavior and their worship to be less offensive to Jehovah, to avoid these lions coming and destroying them. So the people of that region feared Jehovah and their own, historical gods as well. So when they come in and say, we're seeking Jehovah just like you are, they were half right. They were seeking Jehovah, sort of, but they weren't doing it like the Jews were. They weren't seeking him alone. They feared the Lord and they served other gods as well. But they wanted to participate and build with them. It says, "For we seek your God as you do, and we have sacrificed him since the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here." He's the one who had them bring priests in to teach them the right way to worship Jehovah. So they say, "We've been serving him too, you know." But Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, "You may do nothing with us to build the house of our God, but we alone will build to the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." And when the people of the land tried to discourage the people of Judah, they troubled them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now, this period of time, it says they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose. Exactly what these counselors did, it's not clear. It's probable that they hired people to go and to bring evil reports against them to the Persian kings to try to get them to halt the work. It says they did this all the day of Cyrus through the reign of Darius. Now, I gave you a chart earlier to show how much time that is. That's the whole period of time that Zerubbabel and Joshua were leading. And the time from the laying of the foundation of the temple to the time it was rebuilt. The reigns of three kings, Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius the First, span that period. And it says in verse 5, that whole period of time these people were trying to stop them. And they did stop them, temporarily. Because after a couple of years, we read that the Jews kind of discontinued their work. And that's why at a later date, 16 years later, Haggai and Zechariah rose up to stir them up to get back to work and to do it again and to finish the job. So this opposition they received did get, did hit its mark to some extent. It did slow the Jews down. It caused them to discontinue the work for a while. Now, the writer here, in verses 6 through 24, I think, or 6 through 22, I guess. No, even through 24. Or 23. It kind of jumps ahead. It jumps out of chronological order to tell of other times when opposition was faced by the Jews rebuilding the temple. It is mentioned that there was opposition during the period of Cyrus through the reign of Darius. And since it is mentioned that, it wants to skip ahead and tell about some of the later things that are not in chronological order. For example, verse 6 says, "Now in the reign of Ahasuerus," now that's Xerxes. That's the period of the days of Esther, after the death of Zerubbabel and Joshua. It says in verse 6, "Now in the reign of Ahasuerus," or Xerxes, "in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem." We don't have anything about the contents of that accusation, but it's simply mentioning that even when Darius was gone and replaced by Xerxes, they continued to bug the Jews about this. And then verses 7 through 23 skip ahead further to the reign of Artaxerxes and the period of Ezra and Nehemiah. So this section at the end of chapter 4 is kind of skipping way ahead to tell of other, sort of giving a summary of the different times that the Jews faced opposition from these people. And we have a lengthy treatment of the opposition in the days of Xerxes before it jumps back to the period under consideration. Verse 7, "The days of Artaxerxes also built Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of their companions wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the letter was written in Aramaic script and translated into Aramaic language. Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter to King, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to King Artaxerxes in this fashion." Now, from this point on, through chapter 6, verse 18, it's all in Aramaic in the original. From verse 8 on through chapter 6, verse 18. And here's their letter, a lengthy letter. "From Rehum, the commander, Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their companions, representatives of the Dinites, or Dinaites, the Aphrasethites, and the Tarpalites, the people of Persia and Erech and Babylon and Shushan and the Dehavites and the Elamites, and the rest of the nations, whom the great and noble Osnapper," another name for Ashurbanipal, the last great king of the Assyrians, "whom the noble Osnapper took captive and settled in the cities of Samaria, and the rest of the region beyond the river," and so forth. The river meaning Euphrates. The region beyond the river included Palestine, Phoenicia, and Aram, or Syria. And these are the men from that region, writing back to the king of Persia, and saying who they are. Verse 9 and 10 just tells who they are and where they're from. Verse 11, and this is a copy of the letter that they sent him. To King Artaxerxes, from your servants, the men of the region beyond the river, and so forth. Let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you have come to us at Jerusalem and are building a rebellious and evil city, and are finishing its walls and repairing its foundations. Let it now be known. Now notice, it's not talking about the temple, because this is skipped way ahead to the period of Artaxerxes. The temple was finished back in the time of Darius. So we've jumped ahead, and they're not complaining about the building of the temple now. That's already complete. But in the days of Artaxerxes, the wall was being built. And that's what we're looking at now. We're kind of in a parenthesis that's not in the chronological order here. Let it be known to the king that if this city is built and the walls completed, they will not pay tax, tribute, or custom to the king's treasury, and the king's treasury will be diminished. Now because we received support from the palace, it was not proper for us to see the king's dishonor. Therefore, we have sent and informed the king that search may be made in the book of the records of your fathers, and you will find in the book of the records, and know that this city is a rebellious city and harmful to kings and provinces, and that they have incited sedition within the city in former times, for which cause this city was destroyed. That is true. It's true. They were destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar because the Jews were so rebellious. They rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar twice, in 600 BC and in 589 BC, and that's what brought on their destruction. So the accusation is a true one, although these men are not in touch with what God's doing right now, because God is restoring the Jews and forgiving them for that period of sedition. However, Jerusalem's history is not going to look favorable to the king of Persia at this point. We inform the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are completed, the result will be that you will have no dominion over the region beyond the river. Now that is an exaggeration. The Jews were not planning to rebel at this point against the king, and they never did. So this was a lie. It was true about their history, but it was not true about the accusation about their intentions. Then the king sent an answer. That is, the Persian king sent back these men. To Reem, the commander, to Shimshai, the scribe, to the rest of the companions who dwell in Samaria, and to the rest in the region beyond the river, peace and so forth. The letter which you sent me has been clearly read before me, and I gave the commandment, and a search has been made, and it was found that this city in former times has made insurrection against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been fostered in it. There have also been mighty kings over Jerusalem who have ruled over all the princes, provinces beyond the river, and tax, tribute, and custom were paid to them, which may mean that this would be the goal that they have. That is, not to pay tribute to the Persian king anymore, but to have people pay tribute to them again. And that looks bad for them. Now give the command to make these men cease, that this city may not be built until the command given by me. Take heed now that you do not fail to do this. Why should damage increase to the hurt of the king? Now, unfortunately, King Artaxerxes accepted this accusation against the Jews and made them cease for a while. Apparently, when they were made to cease, the enemies also had tore down the wall and burned it down. Although it doesn't say so here, later, during the same reign of the same Artaxerxes, Nehemiah received a report that the walls were in such bad condition, they were burned down and broken and so forth, that Nehemiah got permission from Artaxerxes to go and rebuild them. So Artaxerxes apparently had a change of heart later. But under the counsel of these men, who were probably informers of his, because the ancient kings had informers and spies everywhere, he felt like he probably should close down the work. Later on, perhaps because of the respect he bore to Nehemiah, his cupbearer, Artaxerxes allowed Nehemiah to go and rebuild those walls. Verse 23, now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Reem, Shimshai, the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms they made them cease. And so remember, that whole section from verse 9 on to here has been, actually from verse 7 on to here, has been sort of an interlude, jumping ahead. Now in verse 24 we jump back to the time of Zerubbabel and Joshua. Thus the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, ceased. Not because of Artaxerxes, but because of the opposition they reached in verse 5. And it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. So the opposition that these Samaritans raised after the foundation was laid, during the reign of Cyrus, caused the Jews to cease building for 16 years until the second year of Darius. And that's when Haggai and Zechariah arose to encourage the people to build, which we read of in chapter 5. Then the prophet Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. So, it doesn't say what they said, except that they helped. It says in verse 2, the prophets of God were with them, helping them. But, of course, the content of their prophecies are given in the books of Haggai and Zechariah, which we'll study immediately after this. Verse 2, so Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, rose up and began to build the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. This is after 16 years of discontinuing the work. And the prophets of God were with them, helping them. That is, what Haggai and Zechariah's messages principally were messages of encouragement that the Jews should continue building the house and finish the job. Verse 3, at the same time, Tatnai, the governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai and their companions came to them and spoke thus to them, who has commanded you to build this temple and finish this wall? Remember, they had been commanded to quit by opposition they'd received, but now the God of heaven was telling them to continue, and so they're being challenged again by the Samaritans about whether they have the authority to do this. Then accordingly, we told them the names of the men who were constructing this building. But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, so that they could not make them cease until a report could go to Darius. Then a written answer was returned concerning this matter. Now, here's another letter that was sent to Darius. These are sent by Tatnai and Shethar-Boznai. These men seem to be opposers, although they're a little more fair to the Jews than the one we read about in chapter 4, which actually occurred at a later time, during the time of Artaxerxes. These men are just curious. These are apparently rulers of the far of that region, and they asked the Jews about it, but they didn't make them stop until they could hear back from Darius. They sent a letter to Darius, but the Jews apparently were permitted to keep working while waiting for a response from Darius. We have a copy of the letter. This one turned out considerably different than the one we just read about in chapter 4. This is a copy of the letter that Tatnai sent. The governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai and his companions, the Persians, who were in the region beyond the river to Darius the king. They sent a letter to him in which was written thus. To Darius the king, all peace. Let it be known to the king that we went into the province of Judah to the temple of the great God, which is being built with heavy stones and timber is being laid in the walls. And this work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands. Then we asked those elders and spoke thus to them, who commanded you to build this temple and to finish these walls? We also asked them their names to inform you, that we might write the names of the men who were chief among them. And thus they returned to us an answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the temple that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel, Solomon, built and completed. But because our fathers provoked the God of heaven to wrath, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this temple and carried the people away to Babylon. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to build this house of God. Also, the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken from this temple that was in Jerusalem and carried away to the temple of Babylon, those King Cyrus took from the temple of Babylon, and they were given to one named Sheshbazzar, whom he had made governor. And he said to him, take these articles, go carry them to the temple site that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be built on its former site. Then the same Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and from that time, even until now, it has been under the construction, and it is not yet finished. Now, therefore, if it seems good to the king, let a search be made in the king's treasure house, which is there in Babylon, whether it is so that a decree was issued by King Cyrus to build this house of God in Jerusalem, and let the king send us his pleasure concerning this matter. Now, whereas the letter sent to Artaxerxes in chapter 4 was a very accusatory letter, saying, this is a city that's always rebelled before, and if you let it be built now, it'll rebel against you. These governors, during the reign of Darius, were not necessarily accusing. They're just seeking information. They say, we asked whose authority they had for this, and they said Cyrus had given them authority to do this. Now, we're not sure if that's true or not, so you might want to check your records and see if it's true. But they didn't make any accusations against the Jews. They just said, we asked them this and they told us that. What, would you check up and see if they're telling the truth? So we don't, even though these men would have stopped the Jews if Darius had commanded it, yet it doesn't seem like they're as hostile as the later men who wrote to Artaxerxes to stop the building of the wall were. Now we have the response of Darius in chapter 6. Then King Darius issued a decree, and a search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon. And at Akhmetha, in the palace, that is in the province of Media, a scroll was found, and in it a record was written thus. Now, Akhmetha is another name for a city that's better known as Ecbatana, or Ecbatana. There were four capitals of the Persian Empire, and that was one of the four. There was a capital at Babylon. There was a capital at Susa, which you are familiar with from the book of Daniel. Daniel was in Susa some of the times that we read about him. That was another of the capitals of the Persian Empire. There was also a capital at Persepolis, and then at Ecbatana, which is this city called Akhmetha here. It's Ecbatana. So at this particular capital in the archives, they found actually the record written in the hand of Cyrus, and were able to confirm that Cyrus had done this. So it said, here's what the record said in verse 3. In the first year of King Cyrus, issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be rebuilt, the place where they offer sacrifices. And let the foundations of it be firmly laid. Its height 60 cubits, that'd be 90 feet. And its width 60 cubits. With three rows of heavy stones, one row of new timber. Let the expenses be paid from the king's treasury. Also, let the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple, which is in Jerusalem, and brought to Babylon, be stored and taken back to the temple, which is in Jerusalem, each to its place, and deposit them in the house of God. Now, therefore, Tatnai, governor of the region beyond the river, and Shethar-Boznai, and your companions, the Persians, who are beyond the river, keep yourselves far from there. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God on its site. Remember that the decrees of the Medes and the Persians could not be altered. And since Cyrus had made a decree that they should be able to build their temple, Darius honored it. He didn't, you know, the laws of the Medes and the Persians, once they were made by a king, were not to be altered. So this decree was allowed to stand. And Darius ordered these men to not interfere and to allow the temple to finish being built. It says, moreover, verse 8, I issue a decree as to what you shall do for the elders of these Jews for the building of the house of God. Let the cost be paid at the king's expense from the taxes of the region beyond the river. This is to be given immediately to these men so that they are not hindered. And whatever they need, young bulls, rams, lambs for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the request of the priests who are in Jerusalem, let it be given to them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. He means the Persian king himself. Now, Darius is being very generous. He's not only allowing them to finish the work, but he says, use my treasuries. The taxes that I would usually draw from that region, just give them to them to finish the work. Give them whatever they need. This is not unlike what other kings of Persia had done. Cyrus had done similar things. Again, the note in the NIV Study Bible gives several examples. It says that Cyrus had helped to rebuild some of the Babylonian shrines. Even though he conquered the Babylonians, he had given money for the Babylonians to rebuild some of their shrines at Erech and Ur. Ur is where, of course, Abraham had come from. Cambyses, another king of Persia, had paid for the restoration of the Egyptian temple at Sais. And Darius, besides giving orders to rebuild this temple, had, we know from history, gave orders for the rebuilding of the temple of Ammon in the Karga oasis. I must confess, I don't know where that is. But these are simply examples of other Persian kings. Well, Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius all helped to pay out of the king's treasuries for the rebuilding of foreign temples that had been destroyed by Babylon previously. Why did they do this? Because they believed in all the gods. Of course, they had their own, territorial gods of their own people, but they also believed that the gods of the other nations were real gods. And therefore they wanted to encourage all their subjects to pray to their gods for them, for the kings. There has been found an artifact called the Cyrus Cylinder, written by Cyrus, and it has an inscription that reads like this: "May all the gods whom I have resettled in their sacred cities ask Bel and Nebo," which are the Babylonian deities, "daily for a long life for me." So Cyrus had an inscription that said, all the gods, it's sort of a prayer, all the gods who I have allowed to resettle in their sacred cities, like the God of Israel is resettled in Jerusalem, may those gods ask Bel and Nebo for a long life for me. So I figured Bel and Nebo were prayed to by the other gods. Obviously mistaken, but the reason for their financing the reestablishment of the sacred shrines of foreign peoples was so that those people would pray for the health and long life for him, for the king of Persia. Verse 11, "Also I issue a decree that whoever alters this edict, let a timber be pulled from his house and erected, and let him be impaled on it." Actually, this actually happened to people in the Persian Empire. They impaled many people. It is said that Cyrus impaled 3,000 Babylonians when he conquered Babylon. If you don't know what impaled means, I don't even want to describe it. It's like what you do to a shish kebab. The book of Esther talks about impaling. There was a gallows set up to impale Mordecai, Esther's uncle or cousin. But actually Haman, their enemy, ended up being impaled on it. "And may the God who causes his name to dwell there destroy any king or people who put their hand to alter it and destroy this house of God which is in Jerusalem. I, Darius, issue the decree. Let it be done diligently." Verse 13, "Then Tattenai, governor of the region beyond the river, Shethar-Boznai and their companions diligently did according to what the king Darius said," or sent. "So the elders of the Jews built, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai and the prophet and Zechariah, the son of Iddo. And they built and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel, and according to the command of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, the king of Persia." Now, Artaxerxes didn't have anything to do with this. He is mentioned here by way of anticipation because he later did permit them to rebuild the walls, as we find in the book of Nehemiah. His name is just thrown in there as one of the kings that God used to help the Jews along, although he really wasn't contemporary at this time with the building of the temple. Now, the temple was finished on the third day of the month of Adar, which was in the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Now, they had begun the work on the second year of King Darius, and now this is a couple years later, or 4 years later, right? The temple was completed on March 12th, 516 B.C., just exactly 70 years after its destruction. It was destroyed in 586. It was finished being rebuilt in 516, 70 years later. It took 3.5 years for them to finish the work. Verse 16, "The children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the rest of the descendants of the captivity celebrated the dedication of the house of God with joy. And they offered sacrifices at the dedication of the house of God, 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, according to the number of the tribes of Israel." Now, hundreds of animals were sacrificed, but that's nothing compared to what Solomon sacrificed at the dedication of his temple. He dedicated tens of thousands of animals at the dedication of his temple. But they, as I said, had a smaller budget than Solomon did. But they did make a big festive sacrificial meal of it. And they assigned the priest to their divisions, and the Levites to their divisions, over the service of God in Jerusalem, as it was written in the book of Moses. And the descendants of the captivity kept the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, which was the right time to keep it. For the priests and the Levites had purified themselves, all of them were ritually clean. And they slaughtered the Passover lambs for all the descendants of the captivity, for their brethren the priests, and for themselves. So they kept earlier, we read of them keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Now they're keeping, for the first time, it would seem, the Passover since their return. So they're beginning to restore all the rituals that they had kept prior to the exile. Verse 21, "And the children of Israel, who had returned from the captivity, ate together with all those who had separated themselves from the filth of the nations of the land, in order to seek the Lord, the God of Israel. That is, some of them apparently, maybe some of the Samaritans, decided they weren't going to worship the other gods anymore, but just worship Jehovah alone, whereas they had been serving Jehovah and fearing other gods too. But some people of those nations separated themselves from the filth of those nations, meaning the idols of those nations, just to seek Jehovah God of Israel. And so they were allowed to participate too. And they kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days with joy, and the Lord made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. Strange that he called the king of Assyria, since he's really the king of Persia. However, he was the king over the region that had been Assyria, and perhaps what is meant is that he was, you know, some of those people who had been deported or brought in by the Assyrians were now able to worship God because of the king who now reigned over the same region that had been Assyria, or had been run by Assyria. It's a strange thing to call him the king of Assyria. However, we know that Cyrus is called the king of Babylon in some inscriptions, even though he was the king of Persia. So it seems like Assyria and Babylon, since they were now under the domain of the Persian kings, those kings were sometimes called the king of Babylon, the king of Assyria, because those regions were now under their dominion as well. Anyway, we come now to the end of the first segment of Ezra.